Today on Against the Grain, the widespread protests sparked by the killing of George Floyd are continuing without any end in sight, despite curfew orders. Radical scholar Jordan Camp joins me to place the upheaval that's taking place within the larger history of urban rebellions in the United States. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Unrest continues to roil the cities of the United States, ignited by one more police killing of an African-American man. At a time when states have already deployed tremendous power over society during the coronavirus, municipalities around the U.S., including Alameda County, where this program originates, have imposed curfews. To step back and look at the unfolding events through a historical lens, I'm joined by Jordan Camp. Camp is visiting scholar at the Center for Place, Culture, and Politics at the CUNY Graduate Center, and he's director of research at the People's Forum in New York City. Jordan, how do you understand what's driving the protests, and how would you situate them within the larger trajectory of urban rebellions since the Watts Rebellion of 1965?
Well, thanks, Sasha. First, let me just start by saying that I'm really grateful for the chance to be back on the show. I'm a big fan of what Against the Grain has done and continues to do. So, you know, I really appreciate this opportunity. I also want to just start by saying that, you know, the current moment that we're living in is what the Italian Marxist theorist Antonio Gramsci referred to as a crisis of legitimacy or a crisis of authority. And what he meant by that is a moment where the ruling class has lost its consensus. It's no longer leading, but, you know, dominant, exercising coercive force alone. And so Gramsci goes on to explain that this means that the masses have become detached from their traditional ideologies and no longer believe what they used to. So, you know, we have certain moments where struggle intensifies to a point where there's a legitimacy crisis that deepens and kind of previously separate forces merge. And these moments are very unpredictable, but in my judgment, they offer a unique opportunity for, on one hand, understanding the structure of the political and economic system that we live in, and on the other, for the forces of opposition and the left to chart a terrain out of this crisis. And so I really think this is the strategic imperative of our time. And obviously, you know, the protests that have taken shape over the last week following, you know, the murder of unemployed Black worker George Floyd in Minneapolis are part of this crisis of hegemony or crisis of authority. You know, when this video was captured on video and viewed by millions of people, his experience is kind of symptomatic of the racist and class dynamics of policing in U.S. cities. You know, and so you've seen this kind of cycle of rebellion from Minneapolis to Louisville, Kentucky, Los Angeles, California, Albuquerque, New Mexico, New York City, and beyond. And so, you know, the mainstream commentators surprised that this state violence provoked large street demonstrations revealed a view strikingly divergent from the masses of people in the U.S. It authorized a view of history that I think is untenable. And so, you know, the uprisings over the last week raise fundamental questions about the relationships between race and class, the state, and political economy. But as your question suggests, you know, we've been here before. You know, Watts 1965 was likewise sparked when an unemployed motorist, Marquette Fry, was, you know, stopped and beaten by California Highway Patrol. It sparked a massive, insurrection in 1965. You know, this came at a moment where, like now, you know, the Black working class community was hit hard by unemployment. The unemployment rates in Black communities at that time in California were what they were in the Great Depression for the working class as a whole. And, you know, it revealed a situation in which the kind of advance of the freedom movement, you know, that had sought to overturn Jim Crow racial restrictions had, you know, not altered the material conditions fundamentally for the working class in U.S. cities. And so, you know, when Dr. King came to Los Angeles famously to meet with the young and unemployed and very angry participants in that massive insurrection, you know, he kind of came away from that with a new understanding of what would be required for the freedom movement and entered into a kind of phase two of that movement. And, you know, over the next 3 years of his life, really started focusing on the kind of fundamental class questions that the Watts insurrection raised. Watts was a major turning point, but it was a turning point not only for the freedom movement, but also for the forces of reaction. You know, Ronald Reagan exploits a series of moral panics about race and crime and looting and disorder, you know, into the governor's mansion in Sacramento. And, you know, it was in that period during the late 1960s and into the early 1970s where really California becomes a kind of test case for the new policies around, you know, policing and security that you would see, you know, nationalized with Reagan's ascension to the White House, you know, in the 1980s. It becomes, you know, symbolic for neoliberalism that was in turn globalized. But what we have now, I think, that connects that moment of 1965, and here we are over a half century later, is that, you know, neoliberalism's in a fundamental crisis. Capitalism has reached a dead end. It can no longer, you know, solve the problems that it creates. We're living through, in my judgment, Sasha, you know, the worst economic crisis in the history of capitalism. And you can see it, its signs, it's what Gramsci called its morbid symptoms all around us. Perhaps, you know, most dramatically through the huge increases in unemployment. And we really have to think about this broader political and economic context to understand the murder of George Floyd. Because, you know, after all, when he died at the hands of those Minneapolis police officers, or at the knee, rather, he had recently lost his job as a bouncer, which made him one of the 40 million workers in the U.S. who had joined the ranks of the surplus population since March 2020 alone. You know, black and brown workers have been hit particularly hard, millions losing their jobs, experiencing a rate of unemployment twice as high as white workers. We've seen you know, black people dying at disproportionate rates at the same time from the novel coronavirus, with black people experiencing a mortality rate at 2.5 times higher than whites, at the same time that black people are three times more likely to die from police violence. I mean, this is also what, you know, Malcolm X was warning about in the 1960s when, you know, he went into Los Angeles and saw, you know, huge strings of police violence, the majority of the victims shot in their back. And so, you know, there's a moment where these kind of quantitative insults lead to a qualitative break. You know, the contradictions accumulate and you see them boil over. That's what we saw in Watts in 65. That's what we saw with the Detroit Rebellion of you know, 1967, in LA in 1992, you know, in Ferguson in 2014, Baltimore 2015, and now again.
I do want to ask you how you see the role that COVID is playing in this. As you've just said, African Americans are disproportionately, like Latinos, disproportionately affected by the coronavirus, and in terms of the social effects as well of the economic crisis that has been connected to the virus. People all over the country have ample reason to be enraged about police brutality, and that by itself is enough. But do you see an element of this as being fueled by a rage around the situation with the coronavirus. And I particularly wanted to see how you see that in New York, where you are, since that is a city that has been particularly badly hit by the coronavirus.
You know, there's no doubt about it that the uprisings, again, in my judgment, need to be understood as a product of this historical moment. And certainly there are a number of factors, but perhaps the most prominent ones are the fact that we're living in the worst, you know, economic crisis, perhaps in the history of capitalism, certainly since the 1930s, as you say, the global novel coronavirus pandemic. And I would add also, you know, a crisis of hegemony for the state. And basically, I think these protests are signs that capitalism and the state can no longer solve the problems that they create. You know, the state's failure to respond, the U.S. state I'm specifying here, has led to over 100,000 deaths, makes the U.S. the epicenter of deaths from the pandemic. And as you say, you know, New York is the epicenter of the epicenter. I mean, you know, for weeks on end in Harlem, where I live, you could just hear nonstop ambulances. It's, you know, ravaging this city. It's ravaging this country. And, you know, there's been, what, 370,000 cases in New York, almost 24,000 deaths, over 16,000 of which have been in New York City alone. And without a doubt, you know, race and class are the key factors in explaining who lives and who dies. Again, to stay at the New York example, neighborhoods where poor, Black, Latino residents live have the highest death rates. The, you know, Queens, the Bronx, and Brooklyn have been particularly hard hit, while Manhattan, particularly, you know, the Upper East Side, the Upper West Side, have experienced the lowest death rates. And, you know, these are the same neighborhoods, by which I mean the Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens, that have been ravaged by decades of stop and frisk, broken windows policing, zero tolerance policing, which are analogs to mass incarceration. So, you know, I think that we would be remiss not to kind of, you know, connect the dots, as it were, between these fundamental issues that people are responding to. I mean, you know, this is a situation that I have no doubt is, you know, at the forefront of protesters against police violence's mind. You know, I mean, I would also add that, you know, in addition to the pandemic, to police violence and terror, we also have a situation where, you know, mass incarceration has completely devastated poor and working class communities, particularly communities of color. I mean, just take, you know, Minnesota alone. The state has an incarceration rate of 364 out of 100,000. That's the rate that's grown dramatically over the last four decades, with 21,000 people being incarcerated in the state. It has a higher rate of incarceration than the UK, Portugal, Canada, France, Italy, and I could go on and on. And Black and Native people are overrepresented in prisons and jails. You basically have a situation where criminalized residents of Minneapolis migrate between jails, prisons, and poor neighborhoods in the city, which, you know, again, is the country, in the country with the highest rate of incarceration in the world. I mean, the U.S. incarcerates more Black people than South Africa did at the height of apartheid. And so I think what you're seeing with these protests is a repudiation, you know, a response to this kind of nexus of problems that are being, you know, acutely felt in poor and working class communities of color all across this country. And, you know, amidst the failure to safeguard public health, the Trump administration, you know, evoke moral panics about violence, crime, terrorism, And what they're attempting to do is to shore up consent for a rapid military and police escalation. You know, on Monday, June 1st, Trump threatened to invoke the Insurrection Act of 1807, which would purport to justify the deployment of federal troops in U.S. cities, as it did when George H.W. Bush invoked it in, you know, response to the uprising in L.A. in 1992. And so, you know, I think that we have to really take all of these factors together and understand that what they add up to, again, is a situation where the U.S. state has lost its legitimacy. Liberalism has lost its legitimacy. We ought not make this a partisan issue. There's a, you know, a bipartisan consensus around the prioritization of security. We see Democrat mayors, just like Republican ones, you know, imposing these curfews, which I could talk more about. And basically, you know, tailing the Trump administration in kind of, you know, defining the enemy within, quote unquote, in race and class terms, which have the effect of basically reducing legal barriers to the deployment of military forces within the U.S.
I'm speaking with Jordan Camp. He's a radical scholar and director of research at the People's Forum in New York City, author of Incarcerating the Crisis. I'm Sasha Billy. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So the forces that you're describing, these forces of repression, which, as you indicate, go back a long time, much of the way they get framed, including within the left or the progressive sphere, is that the war on drugs allowed for a kind of coalescing of repression and mass incarceration that led to the increase of police brutality and the vast increase of the number of people who are locked up. But you argue, and you have argued in Incarcerating the Crisis, that that's only one part of the story, that in fact the roots of the kind of repression that we see against African Americans, against Latinos, Native Americans, that repression has much deeper roots in the political alliances and militancy that even predates the Watts Uprising. I wonder if you could tell us about what you mean, what kind of alliances, and how the state has seen them historically.
So, you know, as you suggest, in Incarcerating the Crisis, I, you know, explain that in my view, you know, the war on drugs, while it has certainly, you know, criminalized and demonized working class communities and, you know, particularly Black and Latino communities, that it does not, you know, explain the kind of engine that drives mass criminalization. And the basic reason is that, you know, I cite political scientists who have done the data analysis and have shown, Marie Godchild is the most prominent, that basically if you, you know, let everyone out of jail who's locked up on through the war on drugs tomorrow, you'd still have the largest, you know, carceral regime, or what scholars call a carceral state, on the planet. And so, you know, my question is then, well, why do we have so many people locked up? Why, you know, is it so many poor people and people of color? And I want to know how it's been legitimated. And, you know, in my judgment, it's a response to a series of political challenges that took shape, you know, from the 1930s into the 1970s. And so, you know, on one hand, you had an alliance between kind of anti-racist freedom, radical labor, and socialist movements that saw as their task the abolition of Jim Crow. And they sought to connect, you know, struggles within the U.S. to anti-imperialist and anti-colonial struggles around the world. Most dramatically, you know, this takes shape in the 1950s with the Korean War, you know, the anti-Vietnam War protest, and so on and so forth. And what this added up to by the late 1960s, to come back to Watts in 65, Detroit in 67, you know, the protest that took shape after the state assassinated Dr. Martin Luther King on the streets of Memphis as he joined striking sanitation workers, you know, following the death of a worker there in April or March of 1968. He's murdered on April 4th, 1968. Is that taken together, those events added up to a crisis for what I term a kind of Jim Crow capitalism and the state, which was built on a particular political economy, industrial political economy. This was the height of Fordism. You know, this was a situation in which, you know, black workers were concentrated into factories. But of course, there's a huge surplus population to keep those wages down, which I could talk more about. But that led to a situation in which basically you could no longer legitimate a segregated labor force to keep wages down. And that crisis of Jim Crow took shape at the same time as that industrial political economy of Fordism was unraveling. And so basically my argument is that in response to this crisis, the political and economic elite deployed new narratives, new ideologies to justify, you know, a turn in policy. And this took shape particularly through kind of narratives of law and order and security. And that became a more legitimate way to justify solutions to crisis and to expand basically policing and prisons as strategies of managing crises in cities at the very moment where you start seeing the presence of a kind of permanent structural unemployment in the political economy. And I argue that this is a key feature of what other scholars have termed the neoliberal turn. You know, that neoliberalization is right at, you know, the heart of what's happened with the expansion of policing and prisons. Basically, I'm saying, as we see, you know, the dramatic cuts in education, healthcare, housing, the kind of capacities that could have enabled the state to meet the health crisis represented by COVID-19 was slashed, and instead, policing and prisons there were to contain the kind of social unrest emerging from surplus populations, you know, created through neoliberal restructuring. And those alliances cross party lines. And, you know, while that project is in crisis now, I think, you know, these protests are inconceivable outside of an understanding of how it's devastated U.S. cities, you know, over the last half century.
And yet, actually, that tends to be what's missing from mainstream media reporting of what's taking place. And actually, quite a lot of the commentary, even progressive commentary, about what is happening. That is, whether one focuses exclusively on the dimension in a sort of stripped down way of racial oppression, or seeing that racial oppression as being embedded in capitalism itself. And what you're saying, what you're arguing, is that since the 1960s, when you had all of these urban rebellions that put the state on the back foot in many ways, that you then had a state which itself was going into a crisis of a form and was restructured in the early 1970s, what we now term neoliberalism, but with the slashing of social services, this kind of class war from above, deregulation, and so on, that it was in that context, the remaking of the capitalist state in neoliberal form, that allowed for, and sort of necessitated from their perspective anyway, the mass incarceration of so much of this now surplus population. And you're saying, though, now we find ourselves 50 years later at a different place within the trajectory, that neoliberalism itself is now facing its own crisis. Protest happens in all sorts of ways, and the kinds of ways people even frame their protests can be complicated. But at this point in this trajectory of what you're arguing, the crisis of capitalism, a crisis of legitimacy for neoliberalism, and the intensification, obviously, of repression, do you feel like those of us on the left should be reframing how we're talking about what's taking place?
Well, thanks for the question. I mean, you know, We venture into, you know, always difficult waters with debates on the left, which can be healthy, but they can, you know, also, you know, be divisive. But I guess what I can say is that, you know, it would be important, I think, to wrestle with this long tradition of, you know, anti-racist Marxism and, you know, anti-colonial traditions of Marxism that have refused a separation of race and class. And, you know, I trace some of that tradition in Incarcerating the Crisis. You know, that kind of stretches from, you know, Claudia Jones to W.E.B. Du Bois, Paul Robeson. You know, there's a range of figures, you know, C.L.R. James. You can see this, you know, with Angela Davis. And, you know, I think there are reasons to be optimistic about the ways in which that tradition of, you know, understanding that you have to analyze racism as rooted in the political economy of capitalism and imperialism continues to inform movements, although unevenly. But, you know, I think that one thing that this tradition points to is that while we've had, you know, racism and capitalism and militarism for centuries, that it changes over time. It takes a distinct shape. And we have to attend to the historically, you know, specific shape that it has taken in this specific historical conjuncture. And so when it comes to policing, my claim would be policing is fundamentally about containing unprecedented inequality under capitalism. And it uses a counterinsurgency paradigm used against enemies of the state around the world and are being deployed across U.S. cities. And so what we have is a situation is where protesters against police violence are treated as internal enemies of the state, an enemy that is identifiable as a class of active insurgents. And so to be sure, the Trump administration relies on the racist construction of enemies to justify the expansion of policing, prisons, and permanent war.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'm talking today with Jordan Camp. He's the author of Incarcerating the Crisis, visiting scholar at the Center for Place, Culture, and Politics at the Graduate Center. That's the City University of New York, and co-editor of Policing the Planet. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And today we're trying to situate the rebellion that is taking place right now in a larger historical and social context. Jordan, you mentioned earlier the ways that the state has tried to justify and navigate the kind of repression that it has meted out under neoliberalism. And I wanted to ask you about that. You argue that resistance is always part of the story, and so is counterinsurgency, so is repression from above. And although that repression has a very long history, dating to the late 19th century Indian Wars, that it takes different forms in different times and places. And the ideology, as you mentioned earlier, that was utilized to justify the repression and mass criminalization of people of color and poor people following the rebellions of the 60s was around law and order. And you can see that with Nixon, obviously, with Ronald Reagan, and Trump in many ways continues in that tradition. And I wanted to ask you about the effectiveness of that kind of ideological deployment then and also now, and who it was effective with. Certainly the white middle classes were very much swayed by this idea of these dangerous radicals or dangerous criminals, dangerous people from below, as you note, people who in decades before the bogeyman were communists, then became criminals later on. So you have a white middle class that is afraid of that social disorder, and that's a very effective way of getting their consent for this kind of repression. But it could also be argued that
parts of the white working class. And I would even say you could make the argument, as some have, that even working class people of color in some sectors, in some places, have also gone along with that. I mean, if I don't know what the statistics are now, but a year ago, if you looked at what were the most admired institutions in America, you would see small business and alongside that the police, and that's not just for white Americans. So I wanted to know how you see the role of that, what you term revanchist or reactionary ideology, in demonizing the poor, particularly the poor of color, and its effectiveness historically, and if you could give us a sense of its effectiveness now, if that can be read this early.
You know, the term revanchism, I use it in keeping with the Marxist geographer Neil Smith, who, you know, explained that it could be traced to the bourgeoisie's response to the Paris Commune, the uprising that, you know, shook the world in 1871, and, you know, provided a new model for revolution. And basically what the bourgeoisie did was to exploit panics about, you know, threats to the class order through populism and nationalism. And they attacked the insurgents as enemies within. And what I argue is that basically, you know, revanchism was renewed in response to the, you know, rebellions from below and organized left movements that shook the U.S. and the world, you know, in the 60s and 70s. And what it did was to, you know, target, you know, black people, poor people, women, immigrants, LGBT communities as the source of problems, and argued that essentially, you know, policing would be the solution to that, those problems. And, you know, it's a particularly useful approach that the ruling class in this country can use effectively. I mean, I think Trump has taken up that, you know, script that was already written for him and been able to, as you point out, you know, through nationalism, through racism, kind of redirect the enemy to being, you know, the poor, the dispossessed, rather than, you know, Goldman Sachs, finance capital. You know, it distracts our attention away from the source of political and economic problems, like the fact that we have a huge bloated military budget, you know, that the U.S. has the largest, you know, imperialist state on the planet, the most extensive surveillance apparatus in world history. So you have kind of a, you know, a planetary revanchism that takes place to punish anyone that questions the authority of the U.S. ruling class. I mean, I think that, you know, you can certainly see this directed against the U.S. working class, but, you know, it's directed around the world. I mean, I think this is what animates the U.S.'s efforts to spark a low-intensity war in Venezuela. It's basically a response to their refusal to bow to the confines of neoliberalism. You know, this is what I think led the, you know, U.S. to support the rise of, you know, Bolsonaro, who similarly, you know, exploited, you know, anxieties about law and order and race in the favelas to win consent to you know, a neo-fascist agenda. So, you know, racism is and revanchism are very useful tools for the ruling class. They can't be underestimated. But I think one of the most difficult things to talk about is when, you know, when the victims of, you know, racism and revanchism, you know, wittingly or unwittingly get recruited into those projects. And we can certainly see that, you know, the problem of nationalism is a problem of American nationalism. And certainly, you know, we would be remiss not to note that under the a lot of the protests around police violence, you know, are a continuity with a movement, you know, the movement for Black Lives, Black Lives Matter movement, emerged under Obama. And certainly, you know, we have seen the emergence of a Black elite. I mean, look at Baltimore. That was a rebellion in a city overwhelmingly ran by a Black political class, which, you know, my friend and colleague Kianga Yamada Taylor writes eloquently about. And so I think that, you know, when we're talking about the explosions that we're seeing in cities, we have to account for these changes over time, the ways that elites can now cynically exploit a kind of race discourse, you know, that hides the political and economic roots of problems of policing and prisons and permanent war, as well as the fact that the only way, you know, out of this crisis is through a multiracial working class struggle to fundamentally alter the relations of class power and take on, you know, the U.S. state and its whole apparatus of intelligence gathering and surveillance and policing and prisons. And that's an urgent lesson for us to learn.
And speaking of that state, do you think that the U.S. state has been attuned to changes in rebellion, changes in society in terms of putting down rebellions? I mean, if one were to think from, you know, Watts or Detroit in the 1960s to the L.A. rebellion in 1992 to Ferguson to now, can we say that the police are learning and studying in terms of refining their repressive counterinsurgency tactics?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. You know, my colleague Jennifer Greenberg and I recently published an essay in Antipode exploring some of these questions. I mean, you know, you have a whole counterinsurgency establishment with a network of social scientists, journalists, human rights lawyers, and they study, you know, these urban rebellions from the past in the U.S., but, you know, they study, you know, insurgent movements all around the world and develop their strategies and tactics accordingly. And there's an absolute fascination with the likelihood of urban uprisings again in the U.S. and the world, and they're planning for them. And, you know, we really need to pay attention, I think, to these architects of counterinsurgency, and some of them we lay out in this Antipode piece, when we're understanding these protests now, to see how they're implementing the lessons that they've learned. I mean, dozens of cities have faced protests. As I said before, growing numbers of mayors have imposed curfews. These include Atlanta, Chicago, Cleveland, Dallas, Denver, Los Angeles, Louisville, Minneapolis, New York City, Philadelphia, Phoenix, Raleigh, North Carolina, San Francisco. And curfews, it should be noted, are essential counterinsurgent tactics of the police, which have been used to contain and confine rebellions such as the ones in LA in 1992, Cincinnati in 2001, Ferguson in 2014, and Baltimore in 2015. So the widespread use of counterinsurgent tactics such as curfews, police helicopters, drones, and tear gas are all political expression of the organized violence that's required for capitalism to survive. And so one of the things that I argue is that counterinsurgency enables capitalism to survive by overcoming, you know, geographical barriers to its strategies of accumulation.
Jordan Kemp is my guest. He is the co-director of the Racial Capitalism Working Group at Columbia University, host of the podcast The New Intellectuals. We've spoken to him about his co-authored book, Policing the Planet, and also Incarcerating the Crisis. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, it could be easy in looking at this history of counterinsurgency to think of the forces of the state as being overwhelming and monolithic, that you might have moments of resistance, but then they will fade away and repression will follow. But you're also arguing something different, which is that the sort of ground in which all of these political struggles have been playing out has shifted with the crises of capitalism and the lack of legitimacy of the state. So we had just been talking about one side, repression from above, but I wanted to ask you about the from below side. How do you see these moments when outrage erupts? Do you see them as entirely spontaneous moments? Do you see them as moments that can be shaped by an ideology on the left? Or is this really something where, you know, people may argue on the left on the sidelines, but ultimately aren't really going to have much impact on the forms that protest takes?
Well, it's a tough question, but I think it's an important one for those of us on the left to ask. I mean, you know, to your first question, you know, events like this may appear spontaneous, you know, sparked out of nowhere, but I think it is a mistake. I mean, you don't see a kind of generalized rebellion and insurrection outside of the organizing that has taken place, you know, really for decades that has, you know, elevated, you know, the consciousness of young people particularly. Because if you look and, you know, when I'm talking to my colleagues who are in touch with people in Philadelphia, Minneapolis, New York City, this is overwhelmingly young people. And, you know, they're not necessarily a part of organizations. They're not exactly, you know, in, you know, left-led situations. They're responding to an accumulation of grievances, you know, born out of these conditions. But that's still organizing. I absolutely think that there's, you know, a role for the left to play. I mean, let's go back to Gramsci. You know, one of the things that he says about left intellectuals and socialists, you know, amidst this, you know, genuine upsurge of interest in socialism, I think we would do well to go back and read Gramsci, because one of the things he says is that there is something called common sense and there's something called good sense. And the socialist's task is to go into these communities and, as much as anything else, listen and hear what is motivating people to organize and to rebel. But to be honest, that there are, you know, elements of the system that people understand in their consciousness, but there are parts of it that are more difficult to understand. The international relationship of forces, the political economy of the state, the history of surveillance and of repression, COINTELPRO, about the ways in which, you know, U.S. Counterinsurgency warfare to put down, you know, movements from, you know, South Africa, Brazil, India, absolutely, or in Palestine for that matter, are intimately connected to the conditions that people are protesting against in the U.S. So the task, I think, for the left is, as much as anything else, to elaborate what Gramsci calls a good sense that exists within the common sense. And so that's a complicated and contradictory process of building trust. But the way that you earn trust to do that work of elaboration, to absolutely teach theory as a weapon in the struggle, is by putting your shoulder to the wheel, engaging, you know, in a struggle against racism and police violence and terror. And, you know, I think providing, though, elaborating this message that, you know, the present is not eternal. You know, when politicians try to go back to normal, no. I mean, you know, socialists are exiles from the future. We have to reclaim the future.
Well, let me ask you more about the character of the protests. There's been a lot of hand-wringing about outside agitators. Certainly in Minnesota, the mayor said that the protests were the work of outside agitators, and then was fact-checked, and, you know, of the people who were arrested, vast majority actually were local. On the left, there's some hand-wringing also about white anarchists invading the protests or doing harm. If one looks at footage of the protests around the country, what is striking is how multiracial it is, as well as you say, how young the protesters tend to be. How do you make sense of all of these ideas swirling around about who the protesters are and who they should be or shouldn't be?
This is a timely and very important question, Sasha. I think this is one of the things that distinguishes your work on Against the Grain, is raising the burning questions of the conjuncture. You know, Attorney General William Barr declaring Antifa, so-called Antifa, as, quote unquote domestic terrorist organization and blaming again so-called outside agitator represents what, you know, the historian Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz depicts as the return of COINTELPRO. This discourse of outside agitators has been uncritically parroted in New York City by, where I live, by Mayor Bill de Blasio, by Governor Andrew Cuomo, emphasizing that the source of the violence and the protests are from, you know, white people traveling into the city to whip up anarchy and disorder. And this rhetoric draws on a script that's already been written. It's also disingenuous. I mean, you know, you go into these neighborhoods with these explosive conditions, I can guarantee you that, you know, nobody has to whip it up from the outside. They said this about black people under Jim Crow, you know, when communists went to Alabama in the 1930s, it's outside agitators. And, you know, I mean, what this does is to hide the motivations that people have by the conditions themselves, by the history of struggle, by the theories that they've studied. And I think the discourse or the language of the outside agitator fortifies already existing forms of counterinsurgency, and it legitimates the intensified policing of criminalized sectors of the working class under the guise of protecting them from these so-called outside agitators. And so, you know, Attorney General Barr's words, I think, render vivid how U.S. policing has been and continues to be aimed at insurgencies, at uprisings. You know, after all, police have been essential to the criminalization of dissent. And in my judgment, this narrative serves the interest of political and economic elites. You know, just a word on why we need to understand this as the renewal of COINTELPRO. Many of your listeners will know that COINTELPRO came into being in the middle of the 1950s to crush the Communist Party. It was something that was expanded. It's a counterintelligence program under the FBI that targeted in the 60s the American Indian Movement, the Black Panther Party, the Young Lords, anti-Vietnam war protest. And, you know, by the late 1960s and 1970s, you know, COINTELPRO, or COIN as they call it, Red Scott tactics had basically been integrated into the everyday and routine forms of policing and mass surveillance of working class communities in the U.S. And so, you know, when you see this narrative being renewed, I think it's trying to drive a wedge in this emerging movement, you know, appealing to this idea that, you know, it's, you know, the white anarchist what done it. And what that does is to try to hide, as you say, you know, the absolutely genuine multiracial protests that have emerged. I mean, I've heard stories on the front lines where, you know, people were saying, for example, you know, when the cops were charging them in different cities for the white people to get to the front of the line, that was coming from, you know, people of color, and the white activists did it. And so, you know, there's a multiracial unity that's being forged, you know, in a common struggle. And I think this has been an old script. It's culled from a very old script. You know, the, you know, Mike Davis, who I think, you know, City of Courts basically predicted, right? LA 92. And why? Because what did Mike do? He went into those neighborhoods and he talked to working class people, and he understood that it was explosive. One of the things he said was, you know, LA 92 is a multiracial, is a multicultural riot. And that's what we've got again. But you'll see these media narratives that will depict it singularly as black and brown, I think, to try to distract from the multiracial composition, but also the grievances emerging from the working class as a whole, who see that they have a shared interest in defeating, you know, this military state, this police violence, and engaging in a common struggle for better conditions, for a transformation of the political economy, and for a different future.
Let me end by asking you, Jordan, if there are any conclusions that can be drawn from the political consequences of urban rebellions, whether in the 60s or in 1992, which you just mentioned, in Los Angeles, or more recently in the teens. Are there conclusions that can be drawn about their political effects? And if so, are these rebellions enough?
There are absolutely conclusions that can be drawn about the political effects. I mean, one thing is that it puts the country on notice. I mean, now it will be sketched in the collective memory of the whole world. And of course, though, you know, it creates contradictory outcomes. I mean, you know, what's happened is, again, political and economic elites will respond to these crises by trying to justify authoritarian resolutions of those crises. And that authoritarianism works through cunning ways. You know, it'll be community policing, it'll be diversify the police, but all of these are just schemes basically to, you know, channel more federal funding to police forces and to authorize a redirection of resources, you know, away from the social wage. But those outcomes are not inevitable. They're not inexorable. They're not natural. We could, you know, seize on this crisis of hegemony, this crisis of capital and the state, to articulate different solutions to the crisis. And I think that, you know, this is a historic moment for the working class and for the left to seize on this crisis as a terrain of struggle.
And on that note, I've been speaking with Jordan Camp. He is the author of Incarcerating the Crisis, Freedom Struggles and the Rise of the Neoliberal State, co-editor of Policing the Planet. He is a visiting scholar at the Center for Place, Culture, and Politics at the Graduate Center, CUNY. And you can find links to his writings on our website, againstthegrain.org. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.